All right, Mr. Herman.
May it please the court, I'm Donald Herman. I'm appearing for the appellant, Mr. Tom Weiler, the district clerk of Tarrant County. This is an appeal from a court order denying a plea to the jurisdiction filed in the court below. The plea was based upon a claim of immunity, both governmental immunity and derived judicial immunity. The ultimate question before the court below and this court is, can the district clerk be liable for money damages allegedly resulting from action taken in the course and scope of his duties as an officer of the court, specifically the tabulating and taxing of costs? I'm not going to talk about the background of the case. The case has been here before. Two of the panel members, I believe, served on that panel. But I want to make an initial observation before I get to the substance of the case. The exhaustive research that has been conducted both by the appellant and the appellee tells us one thing. It appears that the relief that's being requested, money damages against a district clerk for actions taken in the course of his duties, has never been awarded by any court in the state of Texas. Indeed, it seems to me that the case of Wright versus Pino, which this court decided some, I guess, roughly 10 years ago, indicates that the remedy available to a litigant where the district clerk incorrectly tabulates or taxes cost is to move to have the cost retaxed. But the relief they're seeking here is not that. The relief is novel. And I submit this case can have a profound effect on the administration of justice in Texas. If a district clerk whose entire responsibility pertains to performing court-related functions of the particular judicial district can be made liable on monetary claims, then I submit the entire concept of immunity will have to be rethought.
Well, sorry to interrupt you, but help me understand better whether your position is that the district clerk's taking a judgment that had boilerplate language about division of costs and then assessing costs against people who had successfully filed affidavits of indigency, did that involve discretion on the part of the district clerk, or as the Texas Supreme Court's decision seemed to indicate, and as I believe Mr. Wilder's counsel at that oral argument said, it was purely ministerial?
If I may, Justice Kerr, let me address that by first addressing the case of the Halsey case, which is prominently mentioned in both briefs. In the Halsey case, arose out of the Darley Routier criminal case, which was of great notoriety. And in that case, the county had asked the court reporter to prepare a transcript. The court reporter did a very poor job of preparing the transcript. It was filled with errors. The county sued the court reporter for a refund of the cost of the transcript, and the reporter claimed immunity. Now, the Supreme Court found there was no immunity and plainly discussed the concept of discretionary acts versus non-discretionary acts, and found that the act of the court reporter in preparing the transcript was not discretionary and therefore not judicial in nature.
Well, but maybe as I understood Halsey, it seemed to me that it was almost like the court reporter's moonlighting, you know, when a party to a case pays the court reporter to prepare a transcript, that's different from the court-related function of being there and taking the testimony.
I wouldn't call it moonlighting, but you're making the point I was about to get to. The real holding of that case was the court reporter was not acting as an arm of the court, but instead was acting by virtue of a contract or an agreement with a party. And I think to understand that case, the best hypothetical is, suppose the trial judge had asked the court reporter to prepare a transcript of a proceeding. And suppose the court reporter prepared an error-filled transcript that operated to harm one of the parties. Under that circumstance, is the court reporter entitled to immunity? I say absolutely yes. Even though the action of the court reporter, the event, the conduct, is exactly the same in both instances. It is the preparation of a transcript. The discretion or lack of discretion is the same in both instances. That's why I think this discussion of whether the district clerk was performing a discretionary act or a non-discretionary act is not determinative. The real test is, was the district clerk acting as an arm of the court in tabulating and taxing the costs? Indeed, in this case, it seems to me that while the complainants argue the ministerial versus discretion distinction, what the complainants really complain about is the district clerk came to a point in the proceedings where he had a decree that allocated the costs and Rule 622 that mandated that he tax the costs, and at the same time had the Rule 145 affidavit.
Right.
And so their complaint is the district clerk made the wrong decision. He exercised his discretion inappropriately. He abused his discretion. I submit it was a discretionary act, if that is significant. I think the Villanueva case is on point on this same discussion. In Villanueva, the trial judge awarded costs and included awarded cost in an instance where there was a Rule 145 affidavit on file. And the court, I believe the Texarkana Court of Appeals, reversed. And it reversed on and entered conditional mandamus. The basis for the reversal was abuse of discretion. How can it be different when the trial judge awards costs inappropriately in the face of a Rule 145 affidavit? How can that be different from when the district clerk does exactly the same thing? And how can you have an abuse of discretion if you do not have a discretionary act at the bottom of it?
Well, do you think that this case could theoretically, I understand that you're arguing both the derived judicial immunity and governmental immunity. To the extent that governmental immunity can be wired around by claiming duress, are you taking the position that both types of immunity would have to be found here, or either one, or
either? And let me address the duress argument. It's established that the trial court and this court, on a plea to the jurisdiction, typically refers to the pleadings, and the pleadings determine the outcome of the plea to the jurisdiction. But it is perfectly appropriate to go behind the pleadings where there is conclusive evidence that negates the existence of jurisdiction. In this case, the complainants alleged the word duress. But the record in the case contained uncontested evidence of the events that the complainants suggest led to the supposed duress. And it all ties to the notice that the clerk sent to the complainants stating that costs were due. The notice does not threaten any imminent action whatsoever. The notice merely recites that the clerk may, not shall or will or must, may pursue execution pursuant to the statutes that permit execution in the state of Texas.
Well, so, but do you think that the record is well developed enough as we sit here today on duress that we could agree that under no circumstances could Ms. Merritt, and I'm not sure whether Ms. Merritt is the is really the only appellee now that we're dealing with or not.
I had that point to discuss.
Do we know enough to say Ms. Merritt could never in a million years ever prove duress?
I think the record conclusively negates duress. And I say that for several reasons. Is the state guilty of duress by adopting a statute that permits execution? I don't think so. If a district clerk or an officer of the court merely refers to a lawfully adopted state statute without elaborating on it at all, can that be duress? I don't think so. Of the eight petitioners that are in this case, Ms. Merritt is the only one that paid any amount of money at all, and it was $54, which was only 1/6 of the amount of her bill. Is that evidence that this notice was causing duress to all the petitioners? I think it undermines that. Indeed, I think duress is conclusively disproved by this record. And if duress is conclusively disproved, then the exception to governmental immunity that relies on duress falls out of the case, and governmental immunity operates to prevent the claim for reimbursement. I do want to talk about the parties. Judge Kerr, since you have brought that up, I don't think I have ever appeared in this court or any other and had the question of who are the parties to this proceeding. In the trial court, there were eight plaintiffs, four represented by Ms. DeFilippo, four represented by Legal Aid of Northwest Texas. The four represented by Legal Aid of Northwest Texas alleged, made no allegations whatsoever against the district clerk. They made no claims. They're simply named in the caption. Of the four represented by Ms. DeFilippo, only one, Ms. Merritt, produced any evidence of a reimbursement claim. And the appellee's brief states that Ms. Merritt is the only appellee, although I don't know how you choose to either be or not be an appellee voluntarily. Perhaps it's available. But it seems to me that this odd circumstance tells us one thing for sure, which is that the plea to the jurisdiction should have been granted as to any plaintiff that did not produce at least an allegation or evidence of payment. I submit that the case of Albert versus Adelstein, which also was decided by this court, holds correctly that a district clerk acting in the course and scope of his or her duties is entitled to derived judicial immunity equal to that of a judge.
Let me ask you whether you agree with the appellee. They seem to be suggesting that you're arguing that no matter what a district clerk does, that there is a blanket-derived judicial immunity. Can you ever think of a circumstance where a district clerk might do something to which that sort of immunity would not apply? Or are you really pushing for just a blanket black and white rule?
Let's break that down into two circumstances. Immunity from suit or immunity from liability. Obviously, the district clerk is not entitled to blanket immunity from suit. The appellees talk about the ultra-virus doctrine. I understand the ultra-virus doctrine. The ultra-virus doctrine is available and, in fact, was pertinent to this case in order to allow a suit against the district clerk to enjoin or seek mandamus from conduct that was inconsistent with his duty or inappropriate. I can't stand here and think of any circumstance under which the district clerk performing as an officer of the court could be subjected to monetary liability unless perhaps he stole money out of the pocket of a litigant in the courtroom while the proceedings were going on, or something of that egregious nature. And in that circumstance, he would not be considered acting in the course and scope of his duties. I can't think of an instance. And I know the courts say that immunity is inherently unfair, but every court that makes that remark follows it with the remark that the benefit to society that flows from having officers of the court and other public officials protected from claims for monetary damage outweighs the inherent unfairness that the doctrine of immunity carries with it. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Herman, your time has passed. Are there other questions of the judges? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Herman. All right, Ms. War.
May it please the court. I'd like to start right off addressing Justice Kerr's question from earlier. Justice Kerr, you asked whether the Supreme Court in Wilder 1, the decision that preceded this one in this very same case, determined that the acts by the clerk, which were defined by Mr. Herman earlier as tabulating and taxing costs, were not already determined by the Supreme Court to be purely ministerial and not judicial. And the answer to that is yes. And I can quote the court the exact language. It is the ministerial duty of the district clerk to tabulate the costs and apply the affidavit of indigency. That's on page 152. And then footnote 29 attached to that language says, the taxing of costs is not an adjudication by the court. It is the ministerial act of the clerk.
But wasn't, you know, and I went back and I listened to the Supreme Court arguments, most of them, because I'm trying to wrap my head around all of this. It seems to me, it's not circular, it's just confusing, let me put it that way. Yes, taxing costs is ministerial, and in the normal circumstance, when you've got a file that says so-and-so is indigent, you know, and there's still that affidavit of indigency, then costs don't get assessed. But is there not a discretionary component at all when a clerk looks at a file and presumably sees an affidavit of indigency and then nonetheless decides, no, I'm going to ignore that and assess costs against this indigent party simply because the judgment says that?
Your Honor, Chief Justice Hecht, writing for a unanimous court, decided the answer was no, that this is ministerial. And just because you're reading the rules, how do you have to read the rules, doesn't mean there's any discretion involved. The court was very clear about this.
Said it was a ministerial duty to tabulate or calculate the costs. It doesn't say it was a ministerial duty to then order that those costs, as tabulated, be paid. It doesn't say that, does it?
Not that particular sentence, Your Honor, but that was part and parcel of the Supreme Court's opinion. In fact, in the Wilder 1 case, the clerk attempted to make a distinction between taxing costs and collecting costs. That's all over the briefing, and the Supreme Court rejected that distinction and nonetheless found his actions in tabulating and taxing the costs and collecting the costs ultra vires.
You suggest that. Where is that language in that opinion where they find that it was ultra vires? Because I searched that opinion for those words, and I never found them.
On page...
A finding.
You're correct, Your Honor. You're correct that... Oh, a finding. No, you're correct that the opinion doesn't use the language ultra-virus, but it was an ultra-virus case. But the language the Supreme Court uses is on page 153 of the opinion, and it terms the clerk's activity a systematic policy that contravenes the law. And that means ultra-virus. Obviously, it's just another way of saying it. I heard opposing counsel say, compare the district judge's allocation of costs with the clerk's taxing of costs and say, how can one be discretionary and the other not? And I would again point the court to the Supreme Court opinion in Wilder that makes a very clear distinction in the language that I just read between adjudication by the court of the correctness, allocation of the costs, which is the court's duty, and taxing of the costs, which is the clerk's duty. And where that goes, Your Honor, this goes directly to judicial immunity. And the court's decision in Halsey, Justice Kerr, you also asked about whether Halsey turned on the fact that the court reporter was, in essence, moonlighting. And I would say it absolutely did not. The court did cite those facts as support for its holding. But the heart of Halsey and its test is, was this a judicial act? The court says to get judicial immunity, a court personnel has to be the functional equivalent of the judge. And nowhere does Mr. Wilder ever assert that he was the functional equivalent of the judge. His argument depends on this court misapplying Halsey and accepting the construct that Halsey explicitly rejects. Halsey explicitly rejects the notion that merely because of your status, your position, you are entitled to judicial immunity. In fact, judicial immunity, as its name suggests, is for judges. And court personnel, doctrine of derived judicial immunity, whereby court personnel get to take advantage of that very specific type of immunity that's normally for judges. This is very, very narrow. It's a very short list of functions that get to take advantage of judicial immunity if you're not a judge. And the court goes into this in detail, the Supreme Court does in Halsey. It gives examples. And one example was recognized by this court in an opinion by Justice Gabriel called Connor versus Gomez. There, the court applied the functional test and to a receiver and said, yes, receivers are the type of court-appointed officers that help the court in its actual judicial function of deciding cases and dealing with money that the court has under its jurisdiction. And in Halsey, the court goes through a couple of other examples. For example, court-appointed psychologists who are acting as fact finders, assisting the court. This is very specific. In contrast to opposing counsel, I can think of no instances where a clerk would be included. You have to be the functional equivalent of a judge. This is very specific.
Let me ask you really, a much more mundane question. Let's say that we affirm what the trial court did and it goes back. Who are the plaintiffs? And if you find yourself where you're having to prove duress to get around governmental immunity, do you think you could have a class certified on a question of duress?
Yes, I do. Your Honor, and just to clarify this, Mrs. Merritt is the only one of our plaintiffs who made a claim for reimbursement because she's the only one who paid. So she is the only appellee because, and she was the only person against whom the plea to the jurisdiction should have been directed because she was the only person with this claim. The other plaintiffs have claims for injunctive relief, claims for declaratory relief,
And I assume that, especially now that Rule 145 has been amended to make clear that judgments that purport to tax costs against an indigent party are void, I'm assuming that going forward, I mean, your plaintiffs other than Ms. Merritt have gotten the relief that they seek, correct?
We're certainly hopeful that the trial court will enter a permanent injunction.
Okay.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So if it goes back, I'm just trying to think through how this would work. So let's say it goes back down, and so then the pleading, the caption is going to be Betty Merritt individually and on behalf of all similarly situated plaintiffs? Is that going to be how
this
would go forward?
Your Honor, a class action is certainly possible, and we've pleaded it. You know, everything right now is stayed in the trial court because of this interlocutory appeal. So we still need to do some discovery on the class action potential, and it might be that we have one. It might be that we don't.
Well, doesn't duress has a pretty big subjective component to it, doesn't it?
Not here, Your Honor. Not here. And let's talk about duress, because I heard opposing counsel talk a lot about what he thought duress should be, but I never heard him once mention the binding Supreme Court precedent on that, which is Dallas Community College District versus Halsey. And Halsey discusses duress in detail. It talks about, it recognizes economic duress. And economic duress specifically can include fear of collection and execution. And if you, Halsey specifically cites and discusses another Supreme Court decision, which is called Highland Church of Christ versus Powell. In that case, a church paid its property taxes even though it believed them to be illegal and then sought reimbursement under the same cause of action that Mrs. Merritt is asserting reimbursement. And the court said, and there wasn't even a collection notice. It was just the law permitting collection. The Supreme Court said, that's enough. In fact, the Supreme Court said that the fear of collection was perhaps the most important fact establishing duress.
Now, do you agree, and I'm not saying I'm right about this, but do you agree that to get around any sort of immunity from liability, that you really have to show duress? In other words, I read the, I think it's the Heinrich case that the appellant cites, which seems to suggest that even if a governmental agency did something to you that cheated you out of money you were owed in the past, the most you can get is prospective relief going forward.
Your Honor, that is for the most part true. Immunity does bar most claims for damages. Now, this is not a claim for damages. And it's really important to look at the Halsey opinion and the opinions, the really tens of opinions that over the last century that have recognized this cause of action for reimbursement that is firmly within Texas jurisprudence. And Mr. Wilder agrees with us here that there's no immunity from a proper suit for reimbursement. So the only question is, have we adequately pleaded and introduced evidence of duress? And of course, all we need to do is establish question of fact, as I believe Your Honor noted previously. We don't have to prove it conclusively at this point in time at the jurisdictional stage. So,
were there special exceptions filed to your client's pleadings below?
Or no,
did this
I don't
just all go
so.
Straight to the jurisdictional issues?
That's right. And of course, it's on the pleadings, and then we had evidence that was at the temporary injunction hearing. But the collection notice itself is sufficient evidence of duress. It says, and it's in tab 2 of your oral argument exhibits, you know, in big red letters it says past due, and on the back it says if not paid within 10 days, an extraordinarily short amount of time, I would say, for any collection, the sheriff may come out and execute. Now, in Highland Church of Christ versus Powell, again, a Supreme Court decision, very similar except without the notice, just with the law. The court said that is evidence of duress. So I believe opposing counsel is completely incorrect when he says that the law or a simple law or rule can never constitute duress. It can. It's discussed in Halsey at length, and it's called implied duress. Economic duress, the court says economic duress is implied duress, and it can be just the existence of a statute that establishes interest or penalties if you don't pay or threatens collection. So that is absolutely enough. And I would say that Mr. Wilder's conception of duress would totally shrink this important cause of action and make it useless and illusory. And if that were true, citizens and businesses could never recover when the government coerces them into paying an illegal fee. And you know, there's a reason that this cause of action has been recognized for over a century, and that's to limit the coercive power of government over its citizens. So this remedy is well established, and the only question is whether we've sufficiently pleaded and proven duress, and there is ample evidence in the record to satisfy what the Supreme Court has said is evidence of duress. I'd like to address just a couple of things that were said earlier. Multiple things that Mr. Wilder is alleging have already been decided against him by Wilder 1, by Chief Justice Heck's opinion for the unanimous court. Retaxing costs as an appropriate remedy, that was flatly rejected by the court. And I don't know that it would do any good at this point, now that the costs have already been paid, to go back and retax them. That's not getting the money back. In any event, the court already rejected that as a necessary remedy here. And I think that's all I have, Your Honors. I would just stress again, oh, my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Warr. Mr. Herman, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I may jump around quite a bit, but please stop me if I lose your attention. The Supreme Court, it's important to understand what the Supreme Court did and did not do in Wilder 1. There was a discussion of retaxing of costs not being adequate remedy at law, and that I agree with that. But that discussion was in the context of whether an injunction was appropriate or not appropriate because the retaxing of costs was an adequate remedy of law and therefore the injunction was not needed. That has nothing to do with what we are talking about here today. What we are talking about here today is a claim for monetary reimbursement, not injunction. The injunction part of this case is over. Mr. Wilder has ceased the activities that were complained of. They haven't occurred in over 4 years. What we're talking about here today is reimbursement, and the retaxing of cost discussion in the Supreme Court is meaningless in this context.
So excuse me, Mr. Herman. I'm looking at the sentence in the Supreme Court's opinion, trying to work through it. I think I know how you would interpret it, but let me just ask you. At the end of the opinion, they say, to the extent that the district clerk has already billed costs and must now take some action to rescind the bills, mandamus would be proper. Are you interpreting rescind the bills as maybe sending out a second notice saying, never mind, or would rescind encompass the idea of, you know, if people have paid that didn't have to pay, should they get their money back?
I don't consider it to include reimbursement. I do consider that sentence to mean that in an appropriate proceeding where mandamus was sought, the trial judge might consider whether some sort of additional notice should be sent out. I would submit to you 4 years down the road, and by that time it'll be closer to 5 years down the road, it is hard to find good reason that the expense and inconvenience of sending out notices to people who never acted on the first notice accomplishes anything.
Do you know if anybody ever got reported to a credit agency?
No, there was never any attempt to collect from anybody even a nickel.
Okay.
There was never execution. There was never a knock on the door or a phone call or anything like that. I'm not sure if I'm outside the record here. If I am, I apologize. I don't think I am. But during the 2 years prior to the entry of the injunction, I think there were something like 2,500 notices sent out, and only 200 or so people sent in even any amount of money, $5, $10, or whatever. The Supreme Court did not hold that immunity from damages was tied to the distinction between discretionary acts and non-discretionary acts. The Supreme Court did not address the issue we're talking about here today. The Supreme Court did not find that any of the people acted under duress or that any payments were made under duress. Ms. Warr says judicial immunity is for judges only. I submit the Adelstein case says exactly the opposite. And in Adelstein, judicial immunity is for judges, it's for district attorneys, it's for prosecutors, it's for district clerks, it's for all of the officials intimately involved in the judicial process. Ms. Warr talks about the Halsey case and the concept of duress. She's actually intending to talk about the Bolton case, Dallas County Community College versus Bolton. In that case, the court concluded that there could not be a showing of duress because there was no evidence of imminent threatened harm or penalty. The cases that can find duress, where you'll find duress is found. There is almost always a financial penalty directly threatened and associated with non-performance. Ms. Warr says that Wilder does not Wilder agrees there is no immunity. I'm not sure where she came up with that. Perhaps I misheard that comment. Obviously, we think the immunity exists in his favor as to these reimbursement claims. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Herman. Thank you, Ms. Warr. We appreciate all the briefing you all have done in this matter and for your submissions to the court. Your case is now submitted and you all are excused as that concludes our morning docket.